I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is very young. He's only 20 years old, and he has become a very prominent education reform activist in this country. He's the author, most recently, of Schools on Trial, How Freedom and Creativity Can Fix Our Educational Malpractice. Nikhil Goyal is with us. He is a journalist. He's written for the New York Times, The Nation, and many other publications. He was named to the Forbes 30 Under 30 list in 2013. He was way under 30. When he was young, he writes in the beginning of his book that he didn't like going to school. He considered himself to be a self-directed learner, and the traditional school environment didn't fit with him. He was told what to do all day, didn't have much freedom, and he just wasn't very interested in a lot of what was being taught in school. So he got out of school 6 months early, graduated, traveled all over the country, and came to a point where he was really being able to pinpoint what was wrong with traditional education, even though he went to a great public school, and examine why it is that those who are among the elite in this country go to really good schools and pay a whole lot of money to go to those schools, and why isn't that kind of educational opportunity, and what is that opportunity that is not available to everybody? We get a lot of calls when we talk about education topics, so I'm sure we will for Nikhil as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Nikhil, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, a great pleasure. I'm glad you wrote about this. It's so important. You talk about the school that you went to, and we'll talk about the schools that aren't very good in this country, but you admit that you had a much better school than most children who are growing up in America who are going to school, right?
Yes. The first school district I originally went to was in Bethpage, a middle-class district, and then I moved to Syosset after my freshman year of high school. And Syosset is known as a very wealthy, affluent, and high-ranking district. So very well-funded, a lot of extracurricular activities and sports programs. And it's known as kind of one of the top best schools in the country in terms of the numbers and quantitative measures.
Mm-hmm. But part of the reason that it achieves that is because they're pushing young people into AP courses that maybe they don't want to be in and to get their rankings up, right?
Yeah, it's at the cost of really high test scores and Ivy League admissions offers. You have, I think, a mental health crisis at schools like Syosset and other wealthy high schools, as well as students who just feel that they're not interested in learning. They just don't feel very passionate about going to school, and they're very alienated by the learning experiences overall.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the fact that you played the game because you wanted to get into a good college. You got mostly A's and B's and tolerated what you call the endless drudgery of your classes. Why was it endless drudgery?
Well, in most of my classes, it's a common model in pedagogy, a pedagogical method of learning. You have a teacher at the head of a classroom, you have telling the students what to learn, they're lecturing. It's very direct instruction. And the students have very little freedom or autonomy over what goes on in that class. There might be some kind of interaction through teachers asking students questions and kind of putting them on the spot. But for the most part, it was very passive instruction. So I was just taking in information, and I wasn't very interested in what I was learning. And not only that, when you have situations where there's a lot of rote learning, for example, the retention of that knowledge is very low. Mm. So you'll cram for hours on end before the exam, and then within maybe a day or two, you'll forget most of that information because it had very little relevance or interest to your own educational experiences.
This is kind of a topper, isn't it? It's so indicative of what you're writing about. You're getting points off for not having the proper five-paragraph format.
Right, right. No, it's incredible. I mean, it's these really silly rules, I think. And I, as a writer, and looking back to my high school experience, I mean, I did not improve very much in my writing in high school or in school in general. I think most of my growth as a writer in terms of reporting and making arguments and analysis, a lot of that happened after high school. And the only parts of high school I think that really did improve my communication and critical thinking skills were in clubs such as speech and debate. Mm-hmm. And those were some of the most enjoyable and worthwhile experiences because they were self-directed. I was able to control the learning experience and have mentorship and guidance from teachers as well as other students.
Yeah, they are so valuable. Oh, speech and debate and all of that, so valuable. You also write, interestingly and alarmingly, about a drug and alcohol culture in your schools. Students in the parking lot smoking cigarettes, getting high on marijuana, popping prescription drugs.
Yeah, it's a major problem, and I think it's, the New York Times has done a number of stories looking at the prescription drug culture in many affluent communities, and Syosset is no different from that. When I drive to school every morning, in the main parking lot, most kids were smoking marijuana or they were smoking cigarettes. It's a very rampant culture in a district like Syosset.
Mm-hmm. You wrote an interesting piece in the New York Times recently about really top-notch schools that the elite send their children to. President Obama, Vice President Joe Biden sending their children and grandchildren to the same school. Arne Duncan, Rahm Emanuel,
right.
Others. Schools that are incredibly expensive but sound like such a wonderful model for the way school should be. Why do you highlight those schools?
Yes, I wrote that piece for The Nation magazine last week, and it was looking at several people, such as Obama, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, and other people who have been basically pushing for something called corporate education reform. And corporate education reform is an ideology that is about standardized testing and school closures, privatization, and really the idea that schools should be run more like businesses. We should be quantifying learning and making sure that schools meet certain standards and performance metrics. And I look at their rhetoric, and they're pushing these corporate reforms in terms of their policy agendas, yet they send their children to schools that completely reject all those policies. So, for example, President Obama sends his children to Sidwell Friends, a very prestigious Quaker school in Washington, D.C., and this is a progressive school. I think it's over $30,000 tuition a year.
Wow.
You have small class sizes, very well funded, almost no standardized testing, a lot of creativity in learning. I mean, these are schools that are completely different from what you see in poor communities of color, which have had the most experience of these corporate reforms. And Chicago is, like, I think, another perfect example. You have Rahm Emanuel, who has basically closed over 50 schools and slashed the education budgets for the city. And meanwhile, he sends his children to the UChicago Lab School, a very famous progressive school started by John Dewey in the early 20th century. Tens of thousands of dollars in tuition, small classes. I mean, the rich have one type of education, and the working class have another type of education, which is underfunded, much more oppressive, and not very much so aligned with the kind of skills and knowledge you want to see in children.
Yeah, you describe them, schools that feature metal detectors, police officers stationed in the building, dragnet surveillance, ironclad rules, routines and dress codes, zero tolerance, disciplinary policies, mindless rote learning, and test prep in classes, teachers and administrators who are underpaid and undertrained and don't look like their students or reside in their communities, inadequate resources, large class sizes, pernicious learning conditions, lack of toilet paper, running water, libraries, counselors, and the list goes on and on. Why do we have such incredible, incredible disparity?
I think the education system mirrors the economic system. So in this country, as Bernie Sanders has been talking about for a very long time, and many other economists, we have incredibly high rates of income inequality. The rich have gotten richer and everybody else has gotten poorer over the past 3 to 4 decades. And in terms of education, we've seen there has been an inadequate funding of public education. And so, for example, in districts such as the one I went to, like Syosset, the school district is spending tens of thousands of dollars per pupil. But in a school district such as Hempstead, which is just 20, 25 minutes away from mine, a very poor African-American and Latino district, the school district does not nearly have as much funding because the school funding models in most parts of the country is based on property taxes. And so property taxes kind of governs how much funding the school is going to get. And so you have massive disparities with how the quality of those school experiences. And like you just mentioned, I mean, many of these schools don't have just basic resources. I mean, I think this is a human rights crisis in many ways, in that many schools do not have toilet paper or running water. They have mold. In Detroit, there's investigative stories that came out a couple months ago showing there's mold growing under the floors of a gymnasium, or rats and rodents just running around the school. I mean, these are conditions you would see in the global South, not in the so-called global North, where it's the developed world. So I think these conditions are appalling and are just show that we have completely abandoned poor working class children, both children who are white as well as children who are of color. In many parts of the country.
And you have to imagine, and I know that you have, and let's talk about some schools that you've seen perhaps in this country where those poor, mostly minority students have class sizes that are small, have not this standardized test going on and on and on, have some creativity and love going to school, like the schools that, you know, our elite go to.
Right.
What happens to a human being when he or she is able to go to a school like that?
Yes, I think there's a movement around this country, and I think this is what we've been alluding to, which is known as the progressive education movement. And the progressive education movement started in the early 20th century in the United States, and has been around for a very long time. And there's thousands of these schools, and many of your listeners may have heard of Montessori schools or Waldorf schools, Sudbury. Big picture. I mean, these are schools that are basically based on a certain number of principles, which are: the child should have freedom and autonomy over the learning process. There shouldn't be any kind of quantitative measures of assessment. There should be instead portfolios and more qualitative measures of assessment. So we actually look at the whole child as opposed to just their standardized test scores. These schools really try to bridge the gap between the school building and the community, so the students are engaging in real-world learning experiences, so going out into the community, volunteering, doing apprenticeships, engaging in experiential learning opportunities. And so it changes, I think, the way a child learns. I mean, children come into the world, I think, as natural learners. They're very curious, creative human beings. And I think the job of a school is to nurture that innate abilities of a child. And I think the progressive schools do that incredibly well, in that they basically create the conditions for learning to flourish, the conditions where creativity can be used at the best of its ability for each child. And so, for example, when you talk about poor kids of color, there's a model of progressive schools in New York State called the New York Standards Performance Standards Consortium, and this is a group of more than two dozen public progressive schools that are basically have been given the autonomy by New York State to, instead of giving the state standardized test, you know, they only have to give one English readings exam, but instead of the regular standardized test, the students are allowed to submit a portfolio of their work, so a science project, a math paper, a history project, to kind of show at a much more richer level their abilities and knowledge of a certain subject. And the evidence shows that these students in the consortium schools have lower dropout rates, higher graduation rates, and they're much less likely to get suspended and get into disciplinary issues. So there's a lot of research to show that many of these models work, and I think the consortium schools are an excellent example of that.
And Nick Hill, what does it take to get consortium schools going?
What I would say to policymakers is that I think the simplest way and the least risky way to get progressive education into the public districts is to just pilot these kinds of programs. So a district could start, or even could do a couple of things. One, they could pilot a program within an existing high school. So there's a lot of models around the United States, such as school within schools. So you have an innovative program where students can kind of opt into it, and they have the ability to do project-based learning, more experiential learning opportunities. They have access to teachers and different types of classes. And you could try this at a at a small level with say 20 to 30 kids in a high school, and then slowly expand it over time. So that's one model to do within an existing high school. Another option is to just build or create a program, an alternative education program, within an existing district. So, for example, in Great Neck, New York, they have the Village School, which is an alternative education school that was started several decades ago that is actually only for kids who have learning disabilities or who have been struggling in traditional schools. So that's one of the problems. You have a lot of these alternative education programs, which are really amazing places and should be accessible to everyone, only reserved for kids who are very much so disenchanted with traditional instruction. So I'd love to see this be expanded to, say, a kid who actually does do well in school but wants more challenge or more interesting opportunities to learn. Mm-hmm. So I think there's two different ways they could try this, school within a school or kind of create a new school within an existing district.
Obviously, we all know that that education in this country is going very much in an opposite direction, so we'll talk about that and what it takes to move to a direction where more children, as Nikhil believes, may flourish. What do you think? Do we have an educational system that makes school drudgery for a lot of students, as it did Nikhil? Nikhil Goyal is a mere 20 years old, and he is the author of Schools on Trial, How Freedom and Creativity Can Fix Our Educational Malpractice. Our phone number here, we'd love to hear from you. Do you agree with him? Do you think that we need more kind of discipline and standardized tests so we get a sense of how students are stacking up against other students? But you have to ask the question, why is it that a lot of the elite in this country do send their children to schools that are very small class sizes, very progressive kind of education, cost a whole lot of money, and we don't afford that experience to others, particularly those who are minorities in this country? What's that all about? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, we love to read your messages always, is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, phone lines are buzzing for our guests. Let's go to Dave in Menominee. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks.
Hi.
Hey, you know what? It sounds like where the problem came in is when No Child Left Behind was brought in. And what happened here in our city, we had a lot of smaller schools that were the grade schools and a middle school and a high school. All the grade schools were closed up, and all those kids were housed in the middle school then. And the middle school kids were crammed into the high school. And in order to fit them in there, they had to get rid of all the shop classes and a bunch of, you know, they gutted every shop class, every automotive class, every small engines class, every wood shop, metal shop, everything, so they could make new classrooms for these new kids to come in. And they got rid of the art classes. They gutted the arts, and they gutted the music and drama classes.
Wow.
So the creativity has been directly gutted from No Child Left Behind.
Mm. Nikhil, what do you say?
Yeah, no, I hear that all the time. It's incredibly depressing. I think it did start a lot of the narrowing of the curriculum, and yes, the gutting of arts, music, physical education, and other kinds of extracurricular activities from the No Child Left Behind Act, which basically required that states test each child in reading and mathematics from grades 3 to 8. And then they attach very ruthless accountability measures. So if the students did not meet certain standards, the school could be at risk of closing or lose funding. I think it's just a tragedy that we've lost so much of the things that actually make kids want to go to school. And actually, it's funny, but I think there is a kind of a revival of vocational education in this country. I think there's more talk around how we can bring back shop class. And one of the movements that's been arising in recent years is something called the Maker Movement. And one of the schools I profile in my book is the Workshop School, which is a project-based learning school in West Philadelphia, a very poor black neighborhood, where they have basically created a program for grades 9 through 12 for students to engage in building a car or using different types of equipment, 3D printers and maker spaces and hacker spaces, and really getting inclined and with knowledge of the tools that could be used for future work and employment. I think there is some hope that people are realizing that vocational education and shop class can not only get the kids skills that they need for work, but can actually make them want to come to school more and become more engaged in learning.
Well, to say nothing of all those skills you wish you had when you get out of school and you don't know how to fix anything.
Right. Yep. There you go.
Dave, thanks very much for your call. Michael in Green Bay. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Hi.
I went to school in a really small rural district in northern Wisconsin, and it had a fantastic music program. And it was really valued over, I would say, other schools in the area. And it became a place where they were known for their music program, always, you know, first in the state, you know, all that kind of thing. And I know it's been cut significantly since I left. I'm 25 now, but it honestly is sad to think about. Like, I would not anything against the school I went to. It was a fantastic school, but it's just depressing to think about, like, how much things have been cut since I left. And I know that I did better in math and science and everything else because I was in, you know, band and choir and other extracurricular events that dealt with music. And I know that that expanded my ability to think and be creative. And it's just kind of disheartening. I don't know. I'm not throwing out any solutions there, but it's just what I've noticed.
Yeah. And what's the national picture on this, Nick Hill? Have you found widespread cutting of those kinds of programs?
Yeah, I think after No Child Left Behind, there have been several surveys and studies that have come out showing that school districts have basically reduced instructional time in not just the arts and music, but also in social studies and science, because in a lot of states, those two subjects are just not tested on the state tests. And so the common phrase I often hear is, what's tested gets taught. And that's the big challenge right now. But I have to say that at the same time, while there is a lot of problems with the standardized testing regime and the power it has over the education system, there is somewhat of a small movement emerging among policymakers as well as other people in education that these tests are not actually in the best interest of children. And so there is a movement to push for portfolio-based assessment. So one of the things in the Every Student Succeeds Act, which was signed by President Obama in December, is that a group of states can basically opt into something called the Performance Standards Authority Program, where they would be allowed to, instead of implementing the regular standardized test, they can use portfolio-based assessments or more authentic forms of assessment that test critical thinking and creativity and collaboration. So this is a group of 7 to 8 states in this body, and I would love to see this model grow. And as it happens, the person who actually was the chief architect of this pilot program was Bernie Sanders as senator. He was one of the people who championed this as he's on the Senate Education Committee. Hmm. So I'm very glad to see that there is some traction and progress being made, and I would love to see more states try to move towards performance-based assessment as opposed to the traditional multiple-choice exams.
And yet, what's going on in the opposite camp is very, very strong right now, as you know, that we keep getting No Child Left Behind, all these different programs, and the testing continues. Teachers are complaining about it, but I don't see that letting up at all. Do you? There's not a huge national movement. I know there are people who have opted out of it, but still, the testing continues, and it's a lot of testing.
Yeah, anti-testing movement is in pockets of the country. I think for example, I'm from New York, and New York is probably the ground zero of the opting out of testing movement. I mean, just right now, it's the week of standardized tests, and last year they found that 20% of the parents in New York State opted their children out of the center.
That's
test.
A lot.
It's over 20%.
Yeah.
I mean, it's over. I think it's over 240,000 parents. So they expect, I was just reading, they expect this number to grow even higher this year. And so I think there is this movement of parents who are basically fed up with the Common Core and the standardized tests. And I expect this to grow very much so in the coming years. It's just that it's kind of siloed into certain communities at this point in certain states. But I think this is a movement that is picking up steam.
Mm-hmm. Michael, thanks for your call. Todd in Green Bay, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. My wife's been a teacher for about 30 years now, and so I hear a lot about what's going on in the school through her and her friends and things. One of the things that I've always believed is that the system that's set up right now in elementary schools and up through high school, where you're changing subjects every hour and moving to a different classroom in many cases, is just absolutely ground zero or a catalyst for developing ADD. I think I don't know how anybody can focus on anything for more than a few minutes at a time and then change gears and go and do something completely different. That's one of the issues that I have. But something that I was hearing about talking with this teacher while I was on vacation, and she was from China. She said when you have students that misbehave or are performing poorly in school, and the teacher sees this, the parent is then contacted, and the parent has to come in and sit in the classroom for a day with the child. And it's more or less kind of humiliates them and more or less kind of gives them a little reason to discipline their children a little bit more. And I think we've gotten away from disciplining anyone, the children at all. And particularly that problem is running rampant in the inner city schools. And the real issue you have to get to there is out of wedlock birth rates and single mothers and single, you know, trying to raise their kids and with no consequences. And I think that's going to solve the problem. When you can discourage that type of behavior and develop some disciplinary tactics in those schools, then you'll start to see things turn around. Until then, you're not going to see anything change.
All right, Todd, thanks for the call. Nick Hill.
Yeah, no, thank you for your comment. So first I would say on your first point, I think that the process of the 9-period day or what have you in different schools, it just disrupts learning. They compare it to this assembly line. You just go from class to class at the sound of a bell. And why is learning broken up into like 40, 45 minute periods? I mean, there's no scientific evidence. There's no basis in science there. It's just like this model that was founded and originated in Prussia and industrial America, and we've just stayed with this model. So I think that it doesn't work. But secondly, on the issue of discipline, I would say that I'm not inclined to believe that the solution is to kind of shame the kid or shame the parent into bringing them into school. A lot of the issues, for example, around misbehavior in school or the high rates of suspensions in schools where a lot of children of color attend, has a lot to do with poverty. And I think if you want to really get to the root of the disciplinary issues, you've got to get rid of poverty. And that is done through more economic measures. But I think the other thing I would say is that in terms of disciplinary solutions, I'm a big fan of restorative justice. So instead of just suspending the kid or just sending them off to sit in a room all day, the better option, I think, is to engage in this process of the student understanding what they did wrong, where the community comes around them and helps them understand their misdeeds and how they can rectify the situation and how they can become trusted again and be part of the community. And I think restorative justice has much better results as opposed to sending the kid off to home, not letting them actually think about what they did wrong, and then bringing them back and the same problems arise. And the Obama administration, as I think a couple of years ago, announced that they wanted schools to get rid of zero tolerance policies because they just found it specifically went after kids of color disproportionately, and it did not actually lead to better outcomes in the future. So I think restorative justice and letting the school community have a much bigger role in disciplinary issues, I think can lead to better outcomes in the future.
I wonder how widespread this is. You tell a dramatic story of talking with young people. I can't remember what state this school was in, but it was a central city school where when walking from class to class, you had to have your arms behind your back with your hands clasped, almost like people were being readied for prison.
Yep. Yeah, it was in that Nation article I wrote last week. And yeah, I was talking with several kids in Philadelphia at a progressive school over there, and they were telling me about their former school experiences, and it is just harrowing. As a journalist, it's amazing, and it's just a privilege to learn from these kids and understand their experiences, because I grew up in a middle-class, upper-middle-class background, and as somebody who grew up in that background, you never really understand what it is like to go to schools where you have metal detectors and police officers, right, and all these very strict disciplinary policies. And these kids were telling me that they have to walk in their former school, they have to walk with their hands behind their backs in a single file line. They had to wear uniforms. If they wore a different color that was not, they were not supposed to, if they wore a different color that was assigned to them, they would be sent home. They would basically have to follow these very strict rules. And in my opinion, it is a way to it is a mechanism of social control, a mechanism to prepare kids for incarceration. And it is no doubt in my mind that the school to prison pipeline in these communities is very much in operation. And I think it is, if we want to create a population of people who are critical thinkers and citizens, and people who can work in a democracy, there is no reason why we should be making kids go through these insane rituals and practices. And I don't think any parent would tolerate this. I don't think any parent, if they were forced to do this, would tolerate this. But we can do this to kids because they have very little power in our society. I just think it's very wrong.
Todd, thanks for the call. Angela in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate what your guest is saying. I appreciate him speaking out for the populations in our public schools that usually collectively don't have a voice. We do currently in Milwaukee have an opt-out. They have a Facebook page, Opt Out Milwaukee. And there's a very small percentage of parents that choose to opt out simply because the awareness of it hasn't grown enough yet, but our main issue here that we struggle with as public school parents is that our state legislation has allowed tax dollars to go toward a private system that has no accountability, and parents, in the interest of safety or getting a better, quote-unquote, better education, are sending their kids to these private schools where there's no accountability. These schools are effectively like little mini businesses, and they do have a different discipline program. So what we're trying to do here is we're trying to, in addition to spreading awareness about opt-out, we're trying to work with our district on the new legislation, the Every Student Succeeds Act, and we're also trying to move legislation that would sort of cap the dollars that would go toward private schools and put investment in our public schools in a community school model, which is the only thing that's really working in our inner city populations right now. There's a couple of great schools, actually a few, that have adopted this community schools model, and it's really working because it helps the children who are living in poverty have sort of an umbrella of care before and after school, and it supports the families who do have single mothers who feel like they can't control what's happening with their child in the classroom, and it helps the teacher because the parents and the teachers have a stronger relationship. So I just wanted to comment about what's happening in Milwaukee and that there are a good number of parents who are really fighting every day. Every week we meet and we talk about this, and we want public dollars for public accountability for our children.
Yeah, thanks, Angela. And send us more information about those community schools. It would be a good talk show. Nick Hill.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for your comment, and really great to hear. I think, so a few things. One is that, I think in as you mentioned in Milwaukee and in other parts of the country, there is a lot of money being transferred from the public system to charter schools, as well as I'm sure private schools as well. And it is a major problem. And I think that one of the things I would, and I don't want to blame the parents here, the ones who are sending their kids to charter schools, because that's, I think it's a very, it's something I want to look at further, because one of the reasons a lot of African-American and Latino parents send their kids to charter schools, for example, is because their public school is failing. Their public school is not funded well. And they see this charter school, they have the kids are wearing uniforms, they're getting good test scores, they're going to college, and they see that, I want that for my kid. Mm-hmm. I think the strategy that I think people who are advocating for progressive public education need to adopt is showing parents that the public schools are failing because the lack of funding in those institutions. And if we fight for funding and we fight for equitable instruction and equitable resources, we can change the dynamic in our schools and move away from this kind of two-tiered system. And so I think that's it's a really good strategy to think about. At the same time, I think on the notion of community schools, I love the idea of community schools. And I was in the book I write about Cincinnati and how they have basically created community learning centers where the school is the anchor of the community. They have dental, medical, healthcare facilities for children to have access to, because I think the school needs to become the kind of meeting place for a community to develop, engage, and grow with one another. And I'm a big fan of the community model. I think it can really put a dent into poverty. I think a lot of kids who are poor do not get nearly enough healthcare and other assistance. And I think a community model community school model could do a lot of great strides in helping that situation.
Nikhil Goyal is our guest this hour. He is the author of Schools on Trial, How Freedom and Creativity Can Fix Our Educational Malpractice. He didn't like going to school very much when he was young, and he considered himself to be a learner who was self-directed, the traditional model of school where people tell you in terms of a lecture form, usually what it is you need to know, and then you have to take a test on it the next day. It didn't sit with him very well. He decided that he wanted to do something about it. He was so frustrated with the system. So he began a very, very detailed investigation of school reform and what schools have been like in other times in this country and who some of the leaders have been in educating children, all children, not just very wealthy children in very progressive schools. He graduated from high school in 2013, so he was only a few years out of high school and has become quite a well-known author on the field of education reform. He's traveled all over. Highlight schools that are doing good things, that are lifting up people who are poor and minority people and people who are disenchanted with how the mainstream media reports on education issues. He's a different voice here. He's 20 years old. It's amazing, isn't it? So we'll welcome more phone calls for him. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our lines have been incredibly busy, but just, you know, keep on trying. Again, I want you to go to Facebook, too, so you can write about your experiences with education, because we learn from each other in this whole process, too. So just go to the Kathleen Dunn Show and let us know what you're thinking. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to more phone calls. Mary in Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Kathleen. I would just like to put in a little plug for Milwaukee Public Schools. I know we get a lot of negative press, but we do have Waldorf School. There is a Milwaukee School of the Arts. A big plug for the language immersion schools, the French, the German, the Spanish.
Yeah, they're great. Mm-hmm.
I have a grandson who went to the French immersion school, and I had I have a son who's in his 30s now, who graduated from the German immersion school. He went there at age 4, didn't know what I was doing to him, came home on the first day of school and said, "Mom, my teacher talks funny." But now he belongs to a German men's singing group.
Oh.
He speaks Auf Deutsch to what he calls many grandfathers. And I did something that has had lasting effects.
Yes.
And had no idea how brilliant I was at the time.
Yes, oh, those
so
are great schools, Mary.
A plug for Milwaukee Public Schools.
Hear ye, I'm with you. Thank you very much. And there are, I'm sure that you found out from your investigation, there are some public schools, despite all odds, doing tremendous things in this country, Nikhil.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like I mentioned, that workshop school in Philly is a public school. And the Big Picture Network is another collection of mostly public schools. And so I think there's a lot of districts who are interested in progressive education. The challenge is how do you implement it and how do you operate in a system where there's such a craze for test scores and accountability. So it's always a big challenge for districts to consider.
And when you define, please define for all of us what you mean by progressive education, what is it?
Progressive education is a philosophy that is characterized by a few things. One is that it believes children are natural learners, that they should have control and autonomy over how they learn, what they learn, where they learn. It believes that teachers and students should have more reciprocal and equal relationships in the classroom. So the teacher shouldn't be the kind of the sage on the stage, but a guide and a facilitator and a mentor. It also believes that there should be communities and schools should be very much so connected with one another. So instead of just spending all your time in a school building, you'll be out and about in the real world, engaging in real-world experiential learning opportunities and experiences. It also believes that children should be allowed to flourish and use their curiosity and creativity at their best level in order to gain skills such as problem-solving and critical thinking. And the goal of progressive education is really to produce children who are lifelong learners and engage active citizens in a democracy. And I think they do quite well at that task.
Thanks, Mary, very much for your call. Jim is next. Hi, Jim.
Hey. Good show. There's lots of room to make comments on here. I'm a retired teacher. A couple of things. One, I was, a shout-out to Cooperative Vocational Education. I don't know where that went. I was taught in a school in Illinois. We had 900 kids. We had 9 work programs. I moved up to northern Wisconsin. We had none. Mm. So I don't know what really happened to that. But anyways, you were talking about discipline. I worked in a minority school on a reservation, and we started a conflict resolution room there. I ran that room. And we dealt with any teachers that had discipline issues. They could talk to the student or whatnot, but when they couldn't handle it and they were trying to teach, they would call my room and we would go down and get the student and bring them back to our room. We'd process the behavior, and we ran that my last 5 years I was there, and it had quite an impact academically and behaviorally. It was like the school did like a 180-degree turn, and we didn't emphasize discipline. We had a sheet, a behavioral sheet, and we went through that sheet and talked about the behavior, and the students had to come up with 4 other behaviors they would use next time in this situation that would have a more positive consequence. It worked out pretty good.
Nikhil.
Great. Yeah, no, that's really great to hear. I think there is this movement for restorative justice and using much less punitive disciplinary measures. And I applaud educators and students and parents and policymakers who consider those policies. I think they do a lot of really good work in trying to get the child to understand what their incorrect behaviors and rectify the situation and help them become more acclimated with the school environment. I'll just give one quick example.
Sure.
I spent some time at the Philly Free School, and they're a small private school. They have, I think, 50% of students who are white, 50% of students who are color. So it's a very diverse school community, and they have something called that is found in many democratic schools called the democratic meeting, and they also have a judicial process where students actually serve on a jury of their peers. If they, so for example, say there was one student who broke the ceiling fan, and in the basement and forgot to tell anybody, or just failed to tell anybody. And so this student was basically written up, and there was this kind of panel of I think three students and a staff member at the school, and the student had to basically defend their actions or say, did I do this wrong? Am I guilty of this? And kind of go through the kind of traditional procedures of a court case. And then this panel of students and the staff member have to decide the punishment for that student and how they would kind of change and make amends to the school community. And so it's just amazing to see these children and very young talk within themselves and dole out punishments and certain types of policies. And I think as a result of this, there's very few rules that are broken in these kinds of environments because they don't want to go through this kind of shaming process. So
right.
I got to go through this jury of my peers and deal with this process and possibly get a punishment. I mean, it's something that many kids don't want to deal with, and I think it creates a much more healthier school environment.
Yeah. Thank you, Jim, very much for your important comments. Nikhil, finally, we're almost out of time. I'm just interested in your path here. You graduated from high school just a couple of years ago, 3 years ago. You were graduated 6 months early. What's been your path since then? How have you been able to climb to such national prominence at such a young age on such an important topic?
Yeah, I for the past couple of years since high school, I've been spending a lot of time in different schools and communities and learning environments to really understand where is education working effectively today and where can policymakers turn to for potential solutions to how we can transform the system. So I've looked at data, looked at the history of public education, and well as the kind of corporate reform movement and how those policies have had consequences on communities such as Chicago and Philadelphia. But yeah, it's just been a really fascinating journey. I think I have a very big curiosity for different issues around politics and current affairs. And I'm very fortunate to have the opportunity to go around and meet different types of people in education.
Mm-hmm. So have you started college yet? Or are you putting that on hold? Or do you even need it?
I've been in college for the past couple of years. I'm at Goddard College in Vermont. It's a progressive institution. I'll be graduating in a couple of months.
In a couple of months. Wow.
Yeah, it's a self-directed learning school. So you get a lot of, it's very much so aligned with pretty much with what I'm talking about. It was started by a disciple of John Dewey, who's basically known as a father of progressive education. It's been a fascinating journey for me to see both in K-12 as well as higher education, these really progressive paths of learning.
So all of that drudgery that you had to live through has put you on a course where maybe you can make things substantially better.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for being with us. It was
Thank you so much.
A pleasure to speak with you. Our guest, Nikhil Goyal. You spell his last name G-O-Y-A-L, in case you're interested in reading his book, which is well worth reading. Schools on Trial, How Freedom and Creativity Can Fix Our Educational Malpractice. He's a journalist. He has been writing for the New York Times, for The Nation, for many other publications, has had speaking engagements really all over the world. And in 2013, he was named to the Forbes 30 Under 30 list. He's also a recipient of the 2013 Freedom Flame Award. Quite a young man, isn't he? Thanks very much to Kendra Smith for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Tomorrow, during our program, the first hour of the show, we'll be talking about Bernie Sanders and whether or not he has made the Democratic Party much more liberal. That should be an interesting conversation. And then the second hour, Peggy Orenstein will join us to talk about her latest piece in the New York Times, which is pretty provocative, how young women are turning to pornography for sex education because frank conversations with parents are happening less often. It will be, I'll tell you now, a fairly direct kind of conversation. So it's good information to have. I must say it was news to me. And maybe it will be to you as well. But important conversation. So I hope you'll join us tomorrow. News is coming up. Thank you very much for listening today. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.